We go to Wuhan, China, where the coronavirus epidemic began, and talk to one of the very first patients. We have her story and reporting on the government's early missteps.
So you had this long period of almost 3 weeks in January where Chinese authorities were aware of the severity of this outbreak, but were not informing the public.
Plus, global markets work to recover after the Dow suffers its worst day since the financial crisis. It's Tuesday, March 10th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is What's News. Italy's lockdown is now nationwide, with only essential travel allowed in or out. There's been nothing like this in Italy since World War II. Italy's prime minister says the strong move is needed as the country faces the biggest outbreak of the coronavirus outside of Asia. Our Eric Silvers reports from Milan, which has been locked down for several days.
The Milanese, who are already a bit of a stoic people, have gotten somewhat used to this. Been out and about today, this morning, and there are people out walking their dogs. There's some people in cars, evidently going to work. You're allowed to go to work. They're discouraging it, but you're allowed to do it. I'm in a park right now. There's two construction sites. They're working. There seem to be fewer people than normal. I pass by there every day, but they are definitely working. But there are some signs that the Italians are starting to take the new changes more seriously. There's a pizzeria by my house that has been open through all of this. The last 2 days, it's had to respect a 6 p.m. curfew. But this morning, there was a sign outside saying that they're closing for the good of the country and that they're hoping that everybody does their part. Another thing noticing is that the 1 meter rule, everybody's gotten pounded into their head that if you see anybody, please keep a meter between you and them, whether it's in an office, in line somewhere, or in the park when they're walking. And that, I can see that's definitely been being respected.
This afternoon, President Trump is expected to announce new moves to combat the economic fallout from the coronavirus. That could include a payroll tax cut. The president spoke about other possibilities in a press conference last night.
We're also going to be talking about hourly wage earners getting help so that they can be in a position where they're not going to ever miss a paycheck. We're going to be working with companies and small companies, large companies, a lot of companies, so that they don't get penalized for something that's not their fault.
The administration plans to meet with congressional Republicans about ideas today. We're reporting that there's something of a split in the White House on the idea of a payroll tax cut, whether it's the right move now, and if so, how big it should be. The White House declined to comment. The coronavirus-stricken cruise ship Grand Princess docked in Oakland, California yesterday after it was held offshore for several days. Screening, treatment, and quarantine on military bases are happening for passengers and crew. The coronavirus is now worldwide, but right now we're taking a closer look at where it all started, Wuhan, China. President Xi Jinping made a surprise visit to the city today, as his country reports a steep decline in the number of new cases. It's Xi's first visit to the city of 11 million that has been locked down since late January. The vast majority of China's coronavirus cases are in the province where Wuhan is. It's a place of tremendous interest to the researchers working around the clock to understand the coronavirus, how it spreads, and what else they can do to contain it. In epidemics, there's typically talk of patient zero, the concept that an epidemic all starts with one person. In reality, it's often more of an idea than an actual individual we can identify for sure. But it is the case that the people who are infected earliest often hold important clues, not just to the virus and its treatment, but also to what the official response got right and got wrong. China has rejected criticism of its response, but our reporting paints a different picture, and the story of one of the earliest suspected cases of coronavirus provides key details. Senior reporter Jeremy Page joins us now from Beijing. So, Jeremy, we still don't actually know who patient zero is, the first person to contract the coronavirus, but you and your colleagues spoke with someone who is believed to be one of the very first suspected cases of coronavirus. Tell us about her.
Yes, that's right. So epidemiologists think that the actual patient zero may have been as early as October or November and may have just either not developed severe symptoms or never reported themselves to a hospital. So they have yet to identify that individual. But we have spoken to this woman, Ms. Wei Guixian, who sold seafood in the market where this virus is thought to have jumped from animals to humans. And she was among a group of workers at the market and some shoppers as well, who started to get sick around the same time in about the second week of December, with similar symptoms, cough, fever, fatigue, aching limbs, those sort of things, and started reporting to local clinics and hospitals, mostly relatively small ones, including some private clinics, mostly near to the market, and came in increasing numbers over the second and third and fourth week of December. And this was really the sort of the first challenge that Chinese authorities faced, and the first misstep, if you like, is that it took them a while to make the connection between all these different cases who had mostly a common link to this seafood market in Wuhan. But then there was a second important thing that they missed early on, which was that some of the very early cases had not had exposure to the market. So that was one of the first indications that the virus was spreading between people, not just, you know, from the infected animals or meat in the market to people, but now that there was human-to-human transmission.
So, Jeremy, tell us a little bit more about that. In tracking this outbreak and connecting the dots here, you spoke to doctors who raised alarms sooner than we heard from political authorities in China. What did you find? And how does that change the timeline?
Right. So around the end of December, you have doctors realizing that there is this outbreak, a link to this market. And some of them are also realizing that there are cases which haven't had exposure to the market, so there could be human-to-human transmission. And so as well as alerting the authorities through official channels, some of those doctors also started to warn their colleagues, their former sort of medical classmates, that this could be an outbreak similar to SARS, the big outbreak in 2002-2003 that ended up killing over 700 people. And so two of those doctors were reprimanded for that reason. We spoke to one who was called in by her hospital authorities and accused of spreading rumors and causing panic in Wuhan just because she'd shared a test result that showed this was a coronavirus with a former medical school classmate.
Officials in China have said they moved quickly to share the news of the virus once they knew what was happening. But that's not exactly what you uncovered.
Yes. So after the alarm was officially raised, Chinese medical authorities did sort of swing into action, and they sent a team from Beijing down to Wuhan, and they started putting all the suspected cases in the same hospital that specialized in infectious diseases. And they took samples, they sent them off to try and sort of sequence the genome and identify, you know, what the cause of this illness was. And certainly by January 2nd, one medical institute had successfully identified this as a coronavirus. So that's something similar to the SARS outbreak in 2002-2003, and sequenced the genome. But what Chinese authorities did not do was share any of that information publicly at the time. They did not warn the public that there could be human-to-human transmission, even though doctors were suspecting that at the time. They did not announce publicly that it was a coronavirus, so similar to SARS, until January the 9th. And they did not announce publicly that it was passing between people until January the 20th. So you had this long period of almost 3 weeks in January where Chinese authorities were aware of the severity of this outbreak, but were not informing the public.
Had this been disclosed publicly earlier, would it have made a difference in what we're seeing now? What did you hear from doctors and patients you spoke with?
Well, it's very hard to tell, obviously, but I think that there is a feeling amongst many of the doctors and experts that we've spoken to that Chinese authorities took too long to warn the public that it was spreading between people and to take strong control measures. So they eventually shut down Wuhan and a couple of other cities on January the 23rd. So that was about 20 million people placed under quarantine, which was a pretty dramatic move. But because you'd had that long period of over 3 weeks in January where effectively the public wasn't told anything and none of those measures were taken, the virus was allowed to spread in that time. So what a lot of doctors and experts feel is that the epidemic had spread a lot more widely than it would have otherwise in that period. And some people feel that, you know, more people died as a result.
That's Wall Street Journal senior reporter Jeremy Page joining me from Beijing. Wei Guixian recovered from the coronavirus and was back at her home when we last checked in on her. For more on this story, head to WSJ.com. Jeremy, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, on to markets. Global markets are staging something of a recovery, clawing back part of yesterday's big losses. After the Dow's worst day since the financial crisis, it's a good time to take a step back and talk about what to make of the recent swings. Here's Asia Markets editor Quinton Webb.
The world's markets are grappling with these very complicated questions about how deep the economic damage created by the coronavirus will be, how long-lasting it will be, how much it will ripple through different sectors of the global economy, how effectively central banks can kind of offset those effects, working in tandem with their counterparts at finance ministries, perhaps, you know, who will also be able to cut taxes and do other stimulative measures. And then on top of that, you had this kind of big fresh shock thrown into the markets over the weekend, which this geopolitical standoff between Russia and Saudi Arabia, effectively Saudi starting a price war in the oil market, which, you know, seems also designed maybe to kind of throw some of the kind of the lower end of the American oil market, the shale oil producers and so on, out of business by making it uneconomic for them to continue. So what is all of this volatility about? Well, it's just about people kind of trying to get to grips with these complicated new dynamics in global markets and, you know, grasping at straws. So one day the market is up quite a lot on some kind of seemingly positive bits of news, and then the next day it's down a lot on some kind of pretty definitively negative news. So that's, we're very jumpy at the moment.
Voters are at the polls in six states today: Michigan, Idaho, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, and Washington. Michigan holds the highest delegate count, and Bernie Sanders is campaigning hard there as he tries to beat a revitalized Joe Biden. Our national politics reporter, John McCormick, has a preview.
It's a state 4 years ago where Bernie Sanders managed to beat Hillary Clinton and, you know, keep that primary going quite a ways into the spring. And so it's viewed as a really critical state in the race. If Sanders can't win Michigan, it's going to really be challenging for him to keep moving forward. He probably will, and he has said that he will do so. But the narrative around his campaign could be pretty challenging if he isn't able to win Michigan, a state that he won 4 years ago.
But this time around, it'll be a tougher matchup.
It's a state that has, a large African-American population, obviously, in the Detroit area. And we saw strong support for Vice President Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden in South Carolina among African-American voters, and obviously on Super Tuesday as well, where he was really powered in a lot of his state victories by Black voters. And so they'll be in play again in Michigan. The state, also has a lot of working class white voters, an important demographic in the general election. Mr. Sanders has had some strength with working class white voters, but Biden is also tends to be strong with that group.
We'll have results as they come in on WSJ.com and analysis right here tomorrow morning. And finally, tired of all those dating apps? Well, you could try business school. It is a bit pricey. A top MBA can have a six-figure price tag. We've got a story today on how more and more couples are falling in love at business school. It's driven in part by the growing number of women in MBA programs. B-school romances tend to be a little different. We talked to a couple who used a Kanban board to organize potential baby names, and another gave their wedding guests a 50-slide PowerPoint deck. For more on their happily ever afters, head to WSJ.com. And that's what's news for this Tuesday morning. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.